Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 8th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, Mary Scott Boria completes her study on social justice, transforming a vision. Today's topic is entitled Current Issues in Racial Healing, Reparations. This is session SBM 2000-10. Let's listen in.
You can start. It's my first time doing that. Well, hi.
Hi.
Everybody. I've said hi to a lot of you, and if I haven't said hi to you, hi. My name is Mary Scott Boria from Chicago, and for the past 2 weeks, and actually kind of for the last 4 days, my topics have been specifically looking at racism currently and kind of looking at it from a perspective of it being a systemic issue in our society that has long historical roots. And so we've done that for the last 4 days. And so the last day, I thought what I would do is maybe have more of a conversation about some current issue or a current issue as it relates to racism. And I'm pretty new to the whole issue around reparations. And so have gotten interested in looking at reparations, and primarily because I think that I have a lot of respect for Randall Robinson and his thoughts, and so thought, okay, he might have something very, very interesting here. And so I'm sort of basing a lot of my comments today on his work. I hope he found those tickets. He didn't look too happy, did he? basically, I'm basing my conversation on his work. And also this week, last week, I found this book, A Reconciliation, in the bookstore. And so it sounded like, oh, here's an interesting fit. And so I picked it up and have begun to read it and find that it is a good companion to a conversation around reparations. And as a matter of fact, I think that, at least for me, a conversation about reconciliation is empty without also a conversation about reparations. And a conversation about reparations is empty without a conversation about reconciliation. And so I felt like there's an opportunity to sort of think about the two of them together.
Are they on your list that you favorite?
The debt, yes, both of them are. And actually, this was ordered by someone who's going to be up here in the next couple of weeks. And so I just took the opportunity to advertise her selection a little bit. So hopefully people will pick that up. But there's been a lot of current conversation around reparations. So I thought I'd just kind of start out by asking if anyone here could tell me a little bit of what they think reparations is, and where have they, where do they feel that they've heard something about reparations or know something or don't know anything about reparations? And you probably, if you don't know much, you know, I know not much more than you. So, I'm not the expert, though I'm very interested in the issue. So I'm just going to open that up to see if there's any.
Wouldn't it involve opening yourself to understanding people that don't come from the same background that you come from?
Okay.
And trying to, in some way, maybe through an individual or through your women's group or your synodical or some avenue, mm-hmm. learn more and then set out to do something mm-hmm. in your own community.
Okay.
Or with our Lutheran Settlement House, like in Philadelphia, that does a marvelous job. Mm-hmm. And I just feel I need more education in that.
Okay.
My understanding of reparation is more specifically governmental, an issue of back payment for
past sins. Right.
Similar to what
atonement.
Uh-huh. Similar to what they've done with the Japanese.
Exactly, but something that the individual can do is what I was thinking.
Okay. I was thinking of more global.
Okay.
Because there was a wonderful, I happen to like the program West Wing.
And oh, it
was
great.
There was one, and they bring up a lot of social issues on there. And there was a man who landed in the aide to the president's office and said, I want $1 billion, I want it now.
No, right.
I said, you're not serious. I said, oh, yeah, I'm serious. Yeah. Well, it got them talking about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, anybody else? Someone said atonement. Anybody else? Who else have sort of heard current conversations about reparations? Anybody? So this is kind of new for, at least it's not a new topic, but it certainly is a new a topic in this manner in the year 2000.
I think it's a topic that's starting to be taken seriously, which it wasn't initially.
Right, yeah. Right. So really, basically, reparations is about just basically what you said, paying debt based upon previous actions, and payment meaning a whole lot of things for a lot of different people. Making payments because of crimes against a group of people by their own government. And in this specific, and in this context, that's specifically what we're talking about. That has caused physical or psychological harm. and then making people whole on the basis of a wrong. So it's both payment, but it's also about wholeness and making people whole. And the idea about reparations is also sort of about restitution, and that group makes some gesture that acknowledges their responsibility, and in this case, the government's responsibility, and to make that whole. I do a lot of work with victim offender programs in Chicago, and there's a tremendous amount of work that's being done on juvenile justice area around victim offender kinds of programming as an alternative to the criminalization of young people. And a lot of that work is based upon the reconciliation work that's done by the Mennonites, and because they have a long history of peace and justice and reconciliation, and it's really based upon the notion of taking responsibility, admitting a wrong, taking responsibility, and then righting the wrong, and that it's a mutual act. It's not a one-sided act, because it also requires the victim to acknowledge and to take action to become whole. So I think that those notions about reconciliation fit very, or restitution fit with what I think Randall Robinson's point is in The Debt, about what it means to repay, what it means to repay from that who is responsible as well as that who's been wrong. So it's kind of a mutual relationship. I also worked for many years in the sexual assault and domestic violence field, and the whole victim sensitive movement is about victims being made whole through the mere action of acknowledging that they also have been harmed, but also gaining strength through their own self-advocacy. So again, I think that's the perspective that I think is important to acknowledge. So what have been some examples, some recent examples that you're familiar with that have been about reparations? Okay. So the Japanese in relationship
to the Indians?
Okay, Native Americans. And in some ways, some of that is about treaty, what's in the treaties, what's written in the treaties. And some of it is also about massacres that have occurred throughout history and repayment in some form for... Randall Robinson cites the massacre of, let me see if I, the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado. and that 700, a massacre of Indians in the Cheyenne village of 700 by 700 soldiers in 1864. And it was just in 1998 that the National Historic Study Site Act gave sort of a site, proclaimed a site, acknowledging that act. Any others that you're familiar with?
Mm.
The Swiss right now are doing a lot of reparation to the Jewish community across Europe. Mm-hmm. But indeed, it's found out that the Swiss weren't as neutral as we might have thought.
Well, they made money, let's say that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Taking a lot of treasures and paintings and gold and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And there's a huge controversy going on in Austria whether they're going to apologize or not, mm-hmm. and whether they will, even their form of government, because of the person who's in charge, whether they'll be continue to be welcome in the European Union.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there are, I've just read on, I guess I was surfing and saw an article written by somebody in Austria saying, so what, we'll just drop out. You can't tell us who to have in our government.
Hmm.
It's not over.
Mm-hmm. No. So there's historical stuff, the Germans reparations to the Jews, both to individual survivors as well as to the state of Israel.
Right.
So, and then what about in the United States, other than sort of in addition to some of the Native American reparations, any that you're familiar with? In 1994, how many of you have heard of Rosewood? There was a movie called Rosewood a couple of years ago, and it just kind of sort of opened our eyes to sort of at least the first and maybe only, I mean, there may be a couple of others, reparations paid to African Americans, not for slavery, but for in the early 1900s, around 1920, there were the largest number of race riots in our country in the South. And what was happening is a lot of soldiers were coming back from the war, wanting to reclaim their jobs and communities, and African Americans had moved into jobs and communities. And so the largest number of race riots occurred in the early 1900s, and the largest number of lynchings of African Americans happened during that period, post-slavery. So Rosewood is a community in Florida, and as the story goes, there was an African-American man who was accused of raping a white woman, which is a pretty common scenario in that time, and was sought after, and in the frenzy, the town was burned down, or the community in which the side of the town that the African-American community lived on was completely destroyed. And so the government of Florida just recently signed a law that paid $2 million to the descendants of the Rosewood massacre. So that was an acknowledgement that the government complied with that massacre that happened, and that community was decimated. And then there currently, I've seen some of the debates on TV, currently debates around Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the riots that happened around the same time in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that one is a little more difficult. And it's about race riots that happened in Tulsa. Tulsa, Oklahoma was considered for the black community, the Black Wall Street of the United States. It was probably where the most wealthy African Americans lived in the country. I didn't know African Americans were in Tulsa. It was a surprise to me. But that it was a very well-to-do community. African Americans owned their own businesses, and again, it was sort of based upon sort of the same kind of frenzy, and the community was totally destroyed. And so the arguments down there, there are a couple of arguments that kind of keep creeping up when you talk about reparations, and particularly when you talk about reparations as it results to African Americans, and it has to do with timing, when these acts occurred, and it also has to do with the so-called sons of their fathers paying for their debts. And so these arguments you kind of hear creep up often. However, as is pointed out in Randall's book, that there are certainly situations in history where many years have gone by and reparations have been paid. So, well, some of those arguments don't, there's precedent against those. And even in the, I just want to read this statement, even in the case of the Jewish claim against Germany, the principle that was set during that time was kind of based on this notion that when a government kills its own people or facilitates their involuntary servitude and generalized victimization based on group membership, then that government or its successor has a moral obligation to materially compensate that group in a way that would make it whole, while recognizing that material compensation alone can never adequately compensate the victims of great human rights. This was in 1952, and this was the statement that was made in relationship to the Luxembourg Agreement, and it was called the Jewish Material Claims Against Germany Conference. And so this was kind of the principle that sort of set forth a precedent for reparations, certainly in that situation. So who can tell me who Randall Robinson is? Anybody have any knowledge of Randall Robinson?
Can I back up just a little bit? I know a little bit about that. And when they, historically, they were very, very cautious because the Treaty of Versailles from World War I is what they felt led us into World War II, was the reparations on the German people from World War I were so extreme. Mm-hmm. So with that as their history, when they got into the reparations for the Jewish people, they entered it with such caution that it was rendered rather inadequate.
Okay, that's a good point. And I think those are kind of, you know, I mean, that's certainly the historical context for a lot of the current debate around it. And so this doesn't make this a very easy.
Is it a very easy issue? Is it the case that the German reparations were paid to the State of Israel? Okay, so they had it was a government to government.
Right. Right.
But then as well as the money, but from the people.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Oh, okay. And the taxation.
Right.
So.
Right. Right. Which is, you know, obviously one of a major sort of the issue of paying, you know, paying for the sins of your father. So let me just say a little bit about who Randall Robinson is. Randall Robinson was probably a major, if not the major, force in the Free South Africa movement. And he ran then, and I think still does run, Trans-Africa. So he's very interested in the whole continent of Africa, but in the 80s got very much, in the 80s and 90s, 80s got very much involved in the Free South Africa movement. And if you know, the United States was one of the very last countries to impose sanctions on South Africa. And a lot of it was his efforts and the efforts of his organization to really focus on economic sanctions and to rally not only the government, he was a lobbyist, but to rally the government's support, but also to awaken the African-American community to South Africa and what it meant. And there certainly is, you know, historically a lot of a lot of separation there between what African Americans understand about Africa.
He's an American. He's an American?
Yes, he's an African American. And he was educated at Harvard Law School in the 60s. So he's an attorney. He has a couple of other books. He's very radical. I mean, his stuff is extremely radical. But I think one of the reasons why people are listening to him now, and certainly he isn't the first to kind of make this public claim of reparations, but I think one of the reasons why people are beginning to listen to him because he was so effective in organizing support for sanctions against South Africa. And so that strategy and that thinking about, you know, how to put that pressure on that government, this very key. And so I think people respect his left-wing leanings as well as his effectiveness. And I mean, who, you know, we don't know what happened in South Africa. I mean, we just don't know, right? I mean, we know publicly what happened, and maybe those people, a friend of mine is going to be down here in the next couple of weeks who's an expert in South Africa, and I'm sorry that he's not here when I'm here. He probably would refute everything I say about South Africa, because he knows and I don't. But who would know? I mean, who would have known that there would have been such a peace? Even, you know, there are tremendous problems in South Africa, but we were all prepared for a major war, a major bloody war. And so it just, it took some important thinking. And I think to get the United States to move in the direction of sanctions was a real big thing. He didn't do it single-handedly. However, he does have a tremendous amount of credibility, at least in the African-American community. let's talk a little bit about kind of some of this history around sort of the current discussions around reparations. Before I do that, what's kind of happening in the 90s? I mean, what are the churches doing? I mean, what's something is happening. There's a lot of public conversation here about slavery and about apologizing for slavery. I mean, it's sort of happening. I didn't, you know, before 5 years ago, I don't remember there being a lot of conversation about it.
Is it part of a chain effect? One group starts the conversation with, first it came to my consciousness over the Japanese. I live in California. Growing up in Minnesota, I had no idea the Japanese had been put in camps during the war. So that became rather prominent, certainly in the 80s, maybe even earlier than that. Mm-hmm. Is it a chain effect from that? One group says, okay, that worked, now what about us?
Mm-hmm. Could be.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But it seems that it's happening,
and it's happening.
And it's sort of given a lot of encouragement. Well, in 1993, John Conyers, who was a congressman in Detroit, who's probably the ranking African-American congressman in Congress, introduced a bill in Congress to acknowledge fundamental injustice and only to study the effects of slavery. Only to study. There was no demand for reparations, but really to just study the effects of slavery. But it never made it out of committee, and out of the 400 and some odd congressmen, there were only 28 co-sponsors. So there was little attention in Congress. But 20 years ago, James Forman went to the Riverside Church in New York, which is a fairly large, prestigious church in New York, and read his Black Manifesto, which he called for churches and synagogues to pay $500 million as a beginning. And that was also met with, as you can imagine, deaf ear. But there's some history. And there's some history that it's both introduced in the government as well as introduced in the churches. So there's some historical relationship there. In 1970, Boris Bitker, a law school professor, cited slavery, Jim Crow, and race-based discrimination in America as having a combined grievous social and economic impact on African Americans. And he crafted one of the initial legal lawsuits against the United States for the crimes of slavery and discrimination thereafter. However, the law states that a suit may not be enforceable in the courts, that his suit, I guess he introduced it as a lawsuit, that states that a suit may not be enforceable in the courts because the federal government has to agree to allow itself to be sued.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's very basic. That is written into the original Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you that are out in this area, A University of Oregon law professor states that even in the midst of debates with his liberal professors on many things, he is met with silence on this topic. So there's, you know, been some attempt to sort of introduce some way to make the claim legally, and that it's, you know, historically hasn't gone very far. In 1915, Cornelius J. Jones, we all know Cornelius J. Jones, right? filed a lawsuit against the United States Department of Treasury in an attempt to recover $68 million for former slaves. And he argued that through a federal tax placed on raw cotton, the federal government had benefited financially from the sale of cotton that slave labor had produced, and for which the black men, women, and children who had produced the cotton had not been paid. So that was in 1915. Well, the federal appeals court held that the U.S. could not be sued without its consent, and it dismissed the cotton tax case. And they sort of state that, however, the merits of the case were never acknowledged. So the basis of the denial was based upon you can't sue us. Not you have a claim, but you can't sue us. But we all know of sort of the post-Civil War notion of 40 acres and a mule. I mean, I grew up knowing that slaves were supposed to get 40 acres and a mule, but that this was vetoed by Andrew Johnson. It was introduced by Lincoln. But it was vetoed by Andrew Johnson. And then later there was a Southern Homestead Act that gave ex-slaves 6 months to purchase land for a low price that they could, you know, spread their payments out over a very long period of time. But very few slaves even had the resources to purchase land. And those that did, primarily in Florida, got the poorest land available. And so that program pretty much failed. So those are kinds of things we might have heard about, but certainly the 40 acres and the mule. How many of you are Swedish? Are there any Swedish? Well, you'd be happy to know, or at least pleased to know, that Gunnjard Myrdal, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but you remember him? He was sort of a sociologist.
Myrdal.
Who said that? Are you up there? theorized that American society's failure to secure ex-slaves with an agrarian economic base led ultimately to an entrenched segregated society, a racial caste system. And I remember that he had some pretty profound things to say about racism. And I remember that from sociology classes. And so he certainly had something to say about the long-term devastation, economic devastation of a group of people if those sort of basic economic, not only needs, but a base had not been secured. So, so there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of history that I think, you know, slavery lasted for 246 years. What other major modern history catastrophes against people or horrendous acts against people do we know of? I mean, he poses the question, he says, if you pose the question in most groups to name the five most devastating acts against people in modern history, that slavery would probably not be one of the ones on the list. That the Holocaust would certainly be on the list, because that's a very recent, you know, something that we are familiar with, and that there's some other kinds of things that have gone on around the world, but slavery might not be one of those things on the list. I started to ask that question, and then I thought, well, this is about racism. They'll throw that in there right away. But it made me sort of think that's, you know, we tend to think about slavery as something that happened then. It's over. You know, get over it. It happened, and that I remember when the movie Roots came out, it was probably the first time in my life that I recognized and that other people, especially white people, talked about, wow, this is a brutal system. Look at what happened. But it was almost as if, look at what happened 100 years ago. It's over, and that system ended. And so there's kind of this sense that we want to forget that. And that it once it was over and the slaves were free, there's nothing that lingers beyond that. Even though we know it, but we don't feel what the effect of that system has on generations beyond that. So that's kind of the some of the history behind at least some of the claims for reparations and some of the ways in which people have attempted to introduce the notion of reparations, and it's all been sort of met with this deaf ear, and certainly even Lincoln didn't. I mean, there's been a recent book written, and I haven't read it, but I'm interested in reading it. You know, there's always this sense that, you know, everybody thought that Lincoln freed the slaves, right? He freed the slaves. You know, he's from Illinois. I like to claim that Lincoln freed the slaves. And there's always sort of this other sort of back here that says, no, Lincoln saved the Union, that he freed the slaves to save the Union. He didn't free the slaves, and then the Union was saved. He, you know, it was the other way around. And that Lincoln certainly was a proponent of sending freed slaves back to Africa, and that he worked to do that and obviously wasn't successful, but that he certainly didn't free the slaves because he felt like this was an equal group of people, a group of people who should be equal, but that it was politically and economically expedient. And for those of you who are history majors, you sort of know all of the sort of historical stuff that was going on during the time. So then what if slavery lasted for 246 years, then what's the current basis for reparations? What would you think would be the current basis for a claim for reparations?
Off the top of my head, I'm thinking make us feel good. Hopefully that's not it. But
okay.
Well, you talked about wholeness. Mm-hmm. What I was hearing at the beginning was responsibility on both sides. The responsibility to acknowledge the wrong done, and on the other hand, maybe to offer forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And say, I accept these reparations, I take responsibility to use them responsibly, whatever it is, to start to heal this rift.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is that more in favor of lost economic opportunity?
Okay. So if you had if the African American community presented a bill to the United States, what would be the itemized? What would be the items on that bill that would say reparations for, you know, this, 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 and this? What would be some of those items on that bill?
Equal opportunity.
Oh, I was gonna say back up a moment too and say reparations from whom? Okay. The United States.
As a whole,
responsible. Mm-hmm. You know, you indicated, you know, the sins of the father.
Right.
How many people in the United States came over as Swedish immigrants, as German immigrants, and really weren't responsible for the beginning of the slavery? Yes, they continued it, but just the same, you know. Who's responsible?
Mm-hmm.
And we all have continued to benefit from the way the system is.
so that reparations represent a conscious intention to change the whole system, that we aren't going to benefit from, continue to benefit from.
And the key word is change.
That's what's going to cause the problem. It's not even an amount of money.
So again, I want to get back to the question of what would be on that bill. Because we'll get to the question about who and how, but what are you paying for? What would we be asking to be paid for?
If you're looking at it from the viewpoint of slavery initially, you have to look at removal of somebody from their place of origin, and that it was unwilling, that it was a forced removal, that the work that people produced was not compensated, they were not compensated for the work that they were doing, so that would be it. Certainly as you go on past the freedom point in the Civil War, then economic injustice, educational discrimination, the list can get pretty lengthy.
So do you think the average person has a sense of what would go on that bill?
No. I don't think the average person discusses racism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
So the bill would be made up of, you know, what, and, you know, one of the things that Randall Robinson does is one little chapter on reparations. You know, and I got this book and I thought, I'm going to read the whole thing. And I read the whole thing and there's one, when are we going to get to the reparations part? You know, and there's one chapter on reparations, but there's a whole lot on, I mean, it's enormous. So a lot, and what was, if we go back to a stolen people, what was stolen? You know, what was stolen? And you kind of almost have to go back to the continent of Africa. What happened? So you ask the question, who's responsible? And it implicates a lot more than
it's global. It's not just
kind of there are Africans that are also responsible for slavery.
Sold their
they captured them, took them to West Africa.
The Spanish, the Portuguese,
transported.
But that's a piece of history that we have to dig into, because certainly you're right that there Africans participated in that. But it's important to understand, you know, kind of what, I mean, there's another book, I can't think of the name of the author, that talks about slavery and talks about the different forms of slavery throughout history and the uniqueness of the United States slave system and the notion that the slaves in the United States would be slaves forever, that there was no way in which they would be free. That they were not, they had no rights. They weren't considered humans.
They were property.
They were considered property. And the basis of that being very different than ancient history, where slaves were caught in wars and there was a notion that eventually they could either buy their freedom or... So there's different ways to kind of think about slavery, but it is, I mean, it does take us back to sort of this globalization of, you know, what happened in Africa, and, you know, it's mind-boggling. And what were the treasures that were lost in Africa? I mean, certainly the Jewish community has claimed that our treasures, our valuables were stolen. But there's kind of this notion that the African-American, the history of African Americans started the moment they landed on the shores of the USA, and that what was, and we know that's not true, but what was stolen pre coming to the United States, so that's a claim, that's a part of the claim, and what does it mean to be uprooted from your people and your culture, lost and stolen? So what's the psychological damage that happens when people are uprooted? So we've got some real specific, you know, economic losses, but we also have some psychological damage that happens to people when that happens. So that's another item on the claim check. So then we have slavery, then we have the ending of slavery, and we have everything that happens after that. So what is, what's, and you said some of the discrimination and education.
Health rights. So often wrongful death or wrongful deprivation of legal rights.
Mm-hmm.
Access to health care. Mm-hmm. Right. At the ending of slavery, particularly in the South, I think, the black slave code, or the black codes, prior to that they were the slave codes, but the black codes in the South, which were really this, the discrimination laws that weren't on the books. They were on the books, but they weren't supposed to be on the books. I mean, they were, our Constitution had certainly said something else, but who could vote?
Right.
Who could own land? Who could travel? I mean, that lasted up until 1964. I mean, it's 1964, I was 14 years old in my lifetime. So we're not talking about 100 years ago. We're talking about 1964. My parents were married in 1948. My mother's white, my father's black. They were committing a crime by becoming married in 1948. So, you know, we have 246 years of a system, but then we have whatever happens after that. And it's no small, it doesn't compare to slavery, but it certainly lingers way beyond slavery. And in some ways, there was a woman, I showed a video yesterday, I don't know if some of you that were here saw the African-American woman, the older woman, who said that it was just, that's just the way that it was, and you just accepted it. And it was almost as if she was like, it was okay because we knew how everything was, and we just lived that way, and that's just how it was. And then everything changes, and we don't know what our relationship to this country is. You know, what laws we're supposed to obey and not obey, and
well,
when is it
legal? We knew our place then.
Exactly. We knew our place. In Illinois, there was a recent lawsuit against the Holiday Inn in my hometown that doesn't have a great history of race relations, but and this was in the 1990s, so this might have been 4 or 5 years ago that the Holiday Inn was sued right outside of Chicago because it had a rule that any African Americans that came to the Holiday Inn were to be put on the first floor.
Oh my gosh.
And they were to be put on the first floor so that if the police needed to come and get them, they wouldn't have a hard time finding them.
Oh.
This was a multi-million dollar lawsuit that Holiday Inn lost.
Okay.
Now, thank God our laws are now protecting rights of people, but this was within the last 5 years. So, I mean, the remnants of slavery have carried on a very long time. So if we start pre-slavery and kind of go on, I mean, there's that check can get very, that bill can get very long in terms of the basis of reparations. Any comments?
I think we have such a distorted view of time, you know, because we are a young country and because of the, for many different reasons, that we think of slavery ending 130, 40 years ago as a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very short time ago when you think of a few generations. And when I think of all the Norwegian stuff that goes on in my family today because of my grandparents coming over from Norway. Well, you know, that's the same thing with African Americans or with slaves. We just have such a, we think that was so long ago, and that's mm-hmm. such a short time ago
mm-hmm.
for all these sins and things to have happened and to expect them to be
mm-hmm.
have gone away.
Mm-hmm. And so there's even kind of two sides to that understanding, and the one side of that understanding is, well, you know, if you've got 200 and almost 50 years of a fully entrenched system that not only that not only is about sort of taking away the economic and sort of the human rights of people, but what the psychological abuses are that happened as a result of that. You say, okay, that's 250 years. Well, you know, and our country is only 400, 500 years old. You know, it's not a lot of time in history. So, you know, we're moving, but, you know, we can't move that fast because it's only, so there's that argument that says, well, it's, you know, it takes a long time for change to happen. And then there's the other argument, and that's an argument that I hear a lot. It just takes, it takes a long time, you know. And then the other argument is, well, it's over. Why can't you get on with it? And there must be something wrong with a group of people that can't get on, that they stay stuck in what happened 250 years ago.
I think the comparison to the European immigrants and slaves are false, because slaves didn't choose to come.
Mm-hmm.
These people left their countries because of economic difficulties or religious problems, and they came here and they worked hard. They're very proud of that, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But the slaves never had a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Their human rights were taken away.
Don't misunderstand. The point I made was that are those people who came over in the 1920s and 1930s,
are they
responsible for what the country that they came to had already done, had already precipitated?
That, right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and my ancestor came over in the 1700s.
So we're gonna put you right at the top of the list of responsibility.
Well, when I tell you who he was, it might be a little easier on tapping up your Muhlenberg. I don't know how racist he was.
And there certainly is. I mean, and I think so how do you respond to that? Who's responsible? We did one day this week, I didn't do a very good job of it, but we kind of talked about this notion of whiteness, and what does it mean to be white, and what is, and if you almost could say white equals America, American, but that's not true, because if you're African American, you're not white. So, but if you sort of follow the immigration history of most European immigrants that come to this country, there's a lot of that loss of history that happened in the United States through the process of becoming an American.
Amen.
American equal white. So in order to get certain privileges in society, you gotta give up your language. You can speak that at home, but you don't speak that in school, or you don't identify with that cultural background, not in the public arena. Are you Swedish or are you German? It does not have a place here. So when I look out at this room here, I don't know where you came from. I see white,
sure,
is what I see. And so what do you give up to become American? And certainly that history is your history to tell and understand. There's a book called When the Irish Became White, which is an excellent book about the history of the Irish people coming to the United States and initially being considered black. And then what happened in the process for that to change? How did they become more integrated into society? But they certainly had to give up their Irishness or a piece of that in order to be accepted. And so what's that process for every ethnic group that has come to America? What do you give up? And, you know, maybe it's okay to give it up. I mean, I don't certainly have that history.
Yeah, I guess that's the question that comes to my mind as well, is that was it really given up because that's what you had to do to become American, or was it given up because that's the language is the common link that we all need to communicate and to succeed, and the American promise, which was greater than the promise of where they came from, where they wouldn't have come here, is to advance and be able to own property and freedom of religion and all those things that we hold near and dear. And so was that a small price to pay? Absolutely. Do we still hold some of those cultural things within our families? They still live.
In some places there, like Pittsburgh, they have the wonderful thing there for 3 days where all the different ethnic groups bring their food, they do dances, and that's wonderful. because you get an opportunity to see where this microcosm, big group, really not a microcosm, of people from different backgrounds have come. Mm-hmm. And they appreciate, they keep up their dances and their food, and they, you know, share them. Mm-hmm. I think that's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
I do. I agree with you.
They ought to do more of that, you know.
I think we're starting to see the change. I mean, it is indeed slow. But I was in the emergency room of a hospital the other day, and for every sign in English, there's another sign in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And in places in San Francisco, I've been, you know, for every sign there is in English, there's a sign in Chinese, or a sign in Japanese, or a sign in Vietnamese.
Sometimes open. It's coming.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's going back. It's not coming, it's going back. There's English only is a huge movement, absolutely.
Well, English is the language of the United States. Yeah, that's really ridiculous.
But don't you think it's a real schizophrenic kind of a history?
Sure.
I mean, it's a real, I mean, because not everybody wanted to, I mean, people came here for lots of reasons.
Sure.
And for lots of immigrants, it isn't happy. It wasn't a happy journey. And that doesn't mean that they didn't think America was a place of milk and honey or whatever. Uh-huh. But it wasn't necessarily because, I mean, we were in the workshop on immigration yesterday, and sort of like this push-pull notion. And so one of the gentlemen from whose family was from Norway, I think, you know, he said, well, you know, we hear the stories of why our people came, or, you know, my group came. He says, but then I came over and I went back home and I asked, so why did our people come? Mm. And, you know, what he discovered is that his mother was having an affair with his cousin. And she hopped on a boat and came over. So, you know, what's the story that she tells? You know, my people were in the United States. Well, you know, there's lots of reasons. But there isn't, I mean, I think the notion that, and I think that's, it's interesting, because there's also this notion, even with immigrants, that, you know, they want to come here. Well, they don't necessarily want to come here. Sometimes they have to come here. Sometimes there's no choice there but to come here. So what do you get when you get here? Well, what's the notion of the melting pot? Mm-hmm. What's that? And who's melting? Whose pot is that?
It's a fake notion.
I mean, certainly.
And I just agree with that too. I think it is a valid notion, and I think I'm getting really tired of people talking about their ethnicity when we are Americans. How many generations does it take to have an American culture? If I sit down with my children, we could identify 7 or 8 different sorts of ethnic backgrounds, but I tell them they're American. What's wrong with that?
I think most people realize that, because they can't get a job unless they know English.
No.
They're not going to give up their Spanish, though, and they're not going to give up their Chinese.
I'm talking about holding on to the ethnicity to the point where you are Norwegian, Swedish, German, and I happen to be living in America. No, you're not. You're an American. Oh, yeah. And the melting pot is real, certainly in California. It's brown. The browning of America is happening. It's not happening in this generation sitting in this room. It's happening in the next generation.
Yeah.
And this talk about race is just not going to be relevant anymore, because we can't, you just can't identify it.
Well, you know, I take your point well, because we did some traveling last year in bookstores that would there would be English bookstores, and there would always be this group of books there, and one of the things they would laugh at Americans about, they would laugh at the French about things, they would laugh at the English about things. They laugh at the Americans, they say, there's no American that comes and says, I'm American. They come and say, I'm Swedish American, or I'm a Spanish American or French American. And Europeans see that as being just hysterical.
It's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I went to Europe in 1964, and I was asked time and again, what are you? And I said, I'm American. No, where'd your people come from?
Yeah. No.
It's changed.
It has changed.
Really?
Because
changes
they laugh
both
at us.
Now.
Yeah, it's changed both ways.
Yeah. But do the African Americans really participate in the melting pot?
I don't think they do. I mean, if you look at historically what's happening when you think about African Americans, what comes to mind? Pardon me?
How can you say it doesn't? You're an example.
An example
of a melting pot.
I don't think so.
We're you said your mother was white, your father's black.
Yeah, it doesn't make me, it doesn't make me...
Melted.
Melted.
Right.
Not Swiss cheese.
You said this previously. You identified that.
I mean, I think the public decides who I am, aside from who I decide who I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's this public identity and there's this individual identity and who I am. And I mean, my generation, I disagree with a lot you said, but I do agree with the notion that in my generation, there was no choice. You were either... No, you weren't either this or that. You were this. There was no choice.
That's what those women said in the video.
That's right. I was African American. I had no choice about it unless I chose to pass as something else. And passing as something else is a very heavy psychological burden. Because I mean, I have an aunt in Kentucky, who is 85 years old. My mother's sister. She still lives in a town that will not allow black people to come there and live. So we don't go there and visit. And we did go there and visit her for like 2 hours, my husband and I. We were kind of ducking under the driving wheel. And it's the home of Colonel Sanders. We all know who Colonel Sanders is, right? And we went to visit her, and the very first time 5 years ago. And I never knew why we never went to visit her. I didn't understand that. And so I was so happy. I saw cousins that I'd never seen before who were older than me. And I looked at these cousins and I saw a mirror of myself. I saw me, I saw my sister. I thought, wow, this is great. I went home and I took all these pictures. I had all these pictures laminated for refrigerator pictures. And I sent them to my aunt and I said, you know, I'm doing these laminated pictures. I want you to put this on the refrigerator, and that my sweet little old aunt, as much as I love her, honest as a, you know, she's the most honest person that exists. She called me up and said, I can't put those pictures on my refrigerator. I can't let people coming in my house know that my relatives are black. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's a melting pot, it's not a melting pot. I can say that I've crossed over, but unless society recognizes that, and it doesn't matter what I do. I mean, it doesn't matter what I do. I still am subject to whoever defines who I am. And so I have to constantly struggle against that. And I think from in 1950 when I was born, times were different because I didn't have a choice. I think young people now are really struggling. And they're saying, wait a minute, but that's still about their own private, personal decision to be able to identify themselves in the way that they choose to identify themselves. But that isn't necessarily what the public policy is about who they are. And so there's still that sort of struggle. And I would say that population of young people will push the argument more and will push that, and certainly with more interracial marriages and such, there will be more opportunity for that. But time will tell. I mean, I think it's hard to know where that leads. And I certainly think that for what we're seeing happening in terms of race relations is a real entrenchment or a real connection between race and poverty. And that... See, the African American community is the poorest community in the United States. Now, with the new influx of immigrants coming from all over the world, that might change. But I don't think so, because I don't think our immigration policy is going to let too many poor people from other countries come here. And they're going to certainly figure out how to get them back home when their wars are over. So there is sort of this entrenchment of an economic disparity between African Americans and whites that really kind of throws it into sort of this class. It's not something that all African Americans face equally. But who was it? I think these little stories crop up every now and then. Who was it? Danny Glover, the actor who said he was in New York trying to get a taxi cab,
right.
And the cab wouldn't stop for him.
Right.
That man has millions of dollars.
Yeah.
He's made it. You know, and we still have these images in our mind about that are based on the color of one's skin, nothing else. So it's you know, the melting pot, and what we sort of think about this, and I'm very curious about sort of the European sort of stories of identity and what that means now, because I don't know what that means.
I have an interesting story. I sat next to an African-American man on the train coming from Philadelphia or from Harrisburg, and he is a supervisor laying track for the subways, and all of the men under him are white except for one Puerto Rican, and then he said maybe they were other ethnic, you know, coming from generations down. I said, do you have any problem? He said, no, the Puerto Rican is wonderful. He said, I can go in my office and sit there, and he gets everybody up, you know, time to do the job. He says, he's a great guy. Now, this man is married to a white woman, and he had a long life story, which he knew he could tell me because I'd never see him again. But he's faced discrimination, but not serious. I mean, he has an identity, but he said his neighborhood in Queens has changed. The young black people there are the ones that are using the word nigger now. They're calling each other nigger. Mm-hmm. And he said they tend to be violent, mm-hmm. because they are not happy. They don't have work, something. And that really bothers him. He wasn't raised like that. Mm-hmm. That wasn't his experience, mm-hmm. as a black person being raised in this country. Mm-hmm. So that really bothers him. So there's this.
But if you, I mean, to me, the ultimate form of racism is when you can get a group of people to believe about itself what you've been telling them,
yes.
for 246 years.
Right.
And if you can get them to do it, you don't have to do it anymore. And you're not guilty of it, mm-hmm. anymore, because they've totally absorbed what you've said about them and they live it out. I mean, that's certainly what we see now. We see a constant an internal assault on each other because, hey, if you tell me I'm dumb and stupid and don't have any brains, I'm going to believe it eventually, and that's the reality I'm going to live out of.
And I'll act it out.
And I'm going to act it out, and I'm going to continually act it out. And so we see it. I mean, it's a, who was it? Malcolm X said the rooster's coming home to roost, or the chicken's,
yeah.
coming home to roost,
uh-huh.
or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it certainly has, it didn't happen yesterday. And we kind of look at things, like you said, we look at things from the last 10 years perspective. We don't kind of go back and say, well, wait a minute, how did we get to this place? We got here, and if we believe, I haven't said many radical things since I've been here this last week, because I am in a white environment, and I'm not stupid. But if we believe that the state of the urban community in America right now is because of what black people have done and do, then we are on the wrong boat.
Absolutely.
And the boat is gonna take us to violent revolution, because what that says is that then we believe there's something wrong with these people,
mm-hmm.
that they can't get it right.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse to accept that. And that's a reality that I have to live with every day. I mean, I have to live with the reality of my brothers and sisters killing each other, cussing each other out on the street. I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed. But if I settle myself to the notion, well, we're just like that because genetically there's something wrong with us, then we've lost. I can't allow myself to believe that. So what's the responsibility to do something about that? Well, let's...
And how does economic reparations play into that?
Well, I haven't mentioned the word economic reparations at this point.
No, you're right.
Okay? But at some point, there's got to be... I have a friend who has a T-shirt. Her and her husband's got a T-shirt. And on the back of the T-shirt is written all of these... It's like a bill. All of these crimes equals, you know, this much money. And two slaves equals this much money. It says they walk around, and at the bottom of it, it says, when are we going to get paid?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I believe to a certain extent, or I think to a certain extent, that in some ways the argument's got to get down and dirty and nasty. And unless we start maybe talking about economics, then maybe we won't get to the point. That, you know, if we stay on this surface of nice feel-good reparations, then I'm not sure if it takes us anywhere. Now, I'm saying this to say that I'm not sure that anybody would believe that we would get economic reparations. I'm not sure that those, I'm not sure that he believes that we would get economic reparations. So then what's the point? I mean, if the point isn't that we're going to get paid, then what's the point? In our discussion the other day, someone says, well, you know, okay, let's settle this. You know, you want a couple of $1 trillion? We got a surplus. Let's just give it to you. Get you off our back. We're sick of you. We're tired of this. Let's just, we'll give you a couple. Is that going to solve the problem of race and racism and what it's done in this country? You know, you guys want money? We're going to give you the money because then we're done with you. We don't have to walk around with this guilt anymore. Does that solve the problem?
No way.
No, why not? Why not?
It changed the heart.
Right. And so what changes the heart? I mean...
That's a really valid question, what changes the heart. And I think very often our emotions follow our actions.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
When we do something, it's like in my own field, in education, California has done something that is causing a lot of scandal, and that's they've lowered class sizes. And yet, even while I think they probably had a lot of poor education going on for a few years at the K through 3 level because they had a lot of uncertified teachers, at least they did it. And maybe now they can go someplace because it had to be done. I think very often it's like forcing yourself to go and apologize to somebody that you don't want to apologize to. After you've done it, you kind of feel apologetic, but you had to do it first. Mm-hmm. Maybe what we need here to change hearts is an acknowledgement. To say, in very simple playground terms, we should have done that. Mm-hmm. You know, we have wreaked violence on this whole race of people by doing this, and we probably shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. And we're sorry we did it, and there isn't any way to go back now, but we're sorry. And maybe the saying of that or the movement in that direction pulls it along. It's just like when I was in college and the Civil Rights Act was being debated and being considered. People were not at the point in their hearts where they believed that law. I mean, there were a great many people who opposed that and didn't think it was a good idea. But because they made it law, at least those people knew better than to act. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were legally culpable if they acted out the way their hearts were, and maybe what we need to do is make the change, make the attitude, make the apology. Maybe people's hearts will get there.
Mm-hmm. So attitude follows action, or whatever. Any other thoughts?
Something keeps sitting in the back of my mind, and that is the lawsuit you mentioned that was filed in 1915. Mm-hmm. That I think it is, you know, we the people who are responsible for making the government accept a lawsuit, and that is what our legislators are for. Mm-hmm. And that lawsuit could still be filed again. It would be very interesting to try. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so nothing happens in a vacuum, right? I mean, we don't sort of put an initiative out there and then just kind of leave it out there, because we know if we just leave it out there and there's nothing around it, nothing happens, right? So we can say, well, this is a wrong, but it's in the process, I think, of debating the issue. I mean, we certainly have lost. I mean, since what, 1968 or 1970, we've lost the ability to have these public dialogues around issues of concern to us, so we're kind of sleepy to it. Well, here's what, in this legal paper that was developed, these are some of the things that they have sort of put forward. Now, this doesn't mean that this is what everyone sort of says ought to be reparations, but this is certainly some of the thinking around that. That, I mean, one example that he quotes in here is that the founders of Brown University benefited from slavery. Mm-hmm. So isn't that a very prestigious university?
Oh, yeah.
How many people benefited from going to Brown University?
Thousands.
Okay, so if we get those who benefited from slavery, that those institutions that still benefit, to acknowledge their benefits from slavery, there might be a price tag you could put on that. that to study the economic gains made as a result of slavery and what is the debt that it was owed to the slaves and the descendants of those slaves. And this particular paper sort of talks about a 10-year trust. It says it's got to be time limited. I don't think 10 years is enough time, but it's a place to start. That there be a K through college free education with special schools available for people needing, you know, sort of the at-risk kind of need. And that educational and economic employment opportunities be available based upon need. That the government fund political organizations to sort of build the ability of communities to advocate for themselves. And that there be some open discussion with other countries that would lead to the development of a plan for debt relief and trade agreements in relationship to Africa. So these are just kind of some of the beginning kinds of thinking about, okay, what would be appropriate reparations, or, you know, some context for building some reparations. So what would be some of the, there are obviously pros and cons about that, that are about this debate. What would be, in your mind, some of the arguments against reparations? Maybe not the set of reparations, but just kind of the notion of reparations. What would be some of, you lifted up one earlier and I kind of stopped you.
Well, I guess it's the who is responsible. I mean, the very people who would be receiving reparations also would be harmed. I mean, there's a number of African Americans who've gone to Black Brown University. Mm-hmm. Are they, because they've benefited, are they going to be responsible for paying reparation as well?
So the whole question as to who would be responsible, this generation, maybe not, this government, maybe not, that's certainly a strong argument against reparations, that why should this generation pay whoever they are.
I mean, you've seen that most of the reparation that's been made to other wronged peoples, be it the Japanese in the internment camps, or the Japanese or the, was it what group of women was it that the Japanese were?
Korean
women that were being concubined, if you will. Right. You know, and even the Jewish people, it's always a small, I mean, you know, less than 1% of what the total wrong was that was done. Mm-hmm. But I think Mary, you're right, it's the act, it's the acknowledgement. You know, I understand, you know, I think the Pope apologized for what was done to Martin Luther earlier this last year. Right. Well, you know, what were the ramifications of that? Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people left Europe, not of choice, because they were forced out because of their religious preference? Mm-hmm. And is the Catholic Church going to start paying money to all those people who, you know, mm-hmm. were wronged in church and mm-hmm. chased out? Mm-hmm. So I think it's...
Again, I think we're in some of these arguments are about dollars.
Yes.
But it's, I think it's also to keep in mind sort of what's the larger debate around reparations, not necessarily just dollars and cents.
And you talked earlier about the flip side. What's the responsibility of the community then that's going to benefit from mm-hmm. that? Do we require that they go to college? You know, mm-hmm. is there a requirement going along with mm-hmm. this?
What form will the reparations take then? Mm-hmm. You know, that sounds like one proposal. There may be others. There may be, you know, we want to have our community centers. We want to have, there's already public school. We want to make sure that there's enough funding for those public schools, that they're adequate. And what we really want is a college scholarship. Mm-hmm. Or,
and that's what
you
were talking about.
Yeah.
And it's a careful balance so that you don't get into the issue of the Versailles Act in World War I and World War II. Is now, have you gone so far as to have wronged another group that is going to cause an injustice that will start the revolution that you talked about,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
the next big one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's obviously lots of cons or lots of reasons why there would be a push against it. And so what about some of the pros? We've sort of lifted up some of the pros of why it would be necessary. I mean, I think one of the strongest is that there's a real moral obligation.
It's the right thing to do.
It's a real moral obligation to, and you know, this, there's a lot of conversation about, so what does sorry mean? You know, some say, oh, you know, somebody says they're sorry. Okay, sorry didn't, you know, put me through school or whatever. But the acknowledgement of wrong 200 for 246 years is one thing. But also the acknowledgement of how it has continued and why a group of people are in the position that they're in because of that is a tremendous statement. Because in the year 2000, we still believe that black ghettos in this country happen because of black people and what they do and don't do. And so to have a public debate about the legacy of racism, about the legacy of slavery, is a tremendous acknowledgement of what really happened. It's about truth telling. And so what, you know, and you know, you'll say, well, whose truth is it? Well, it's about putting it out there and having the debate about what it means, and allowing a group of people to feel that the story of what happened and how it's continued is acknowledged. And so that's a big step, because most of America is nowhere there. So to really kind of promote that kind of public debate and do it around the notion of reparations, I think is a tremendous amount of work to put it in back into the public arena. Well, the point that Randall Robinson makes in his book, I think, is that he talks about the battle being waged by people of color. And as I was kind of thinking about this again this morning, I thought, so why am I having this conversation with you guys? Because if the point is not for me to convince you guys, the point is that we can convince ourselves that there's a basis for the debate. And that, what does that mean? He says that there's no hope of healing the racial divide unless the economic gap is closed. Now, whether or not reparations is what does it or something else, that until we close the gap economically, because that's where the divide is happening, and that's where the divide is continuing, until that happens, there's no hope for racial healing, because we've got a whole group of people, based on the color of their skin, that are at the bottom. And that doesn't mean that there are some who are rising to the top, but it's not as many as we think. It's not as many as we think. And that here's a notion that he put out. I'm going to think about this a little bit more. That American capitalism, our American capitalism, starts each child where its parents left off. And that it's a not that it and his notion is that it's not a fair system.
The vicious cycle.
That the cycle continues, and it gets worse. But that the battle is really within the African, and you know, again, this is an African American phenomenon, is based in the African American community. And that the struggle to recover history, to get people who don't have a sense of who they are, to be able to go back and claim that Africans were a very proud people. That the African continent pre-slavery was a strong continent. Can you imagine the sort of the mental? I mean, Roots was a tremendous phenomenon for African American people. So that's the basis. And I'm sorry we didn't get to more of what we had here, but I encourage you to read the book and to think about it. And as actually, this is really, I think, for church people, this is a really good companion to this. You can't do this without this. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you.